This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From a field office in Alberta, Canada, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
America's surrender to the Taliban and its retreat from Afghanistan is the worst foreign policy disaster in American history, and one for which the U.S. and the world will pay for years to come. But Joe Biden and his administration are calling it an extraordinary success. We've just sent our October Trumpet print edition to press. It's a special report called The End of America in Afghanistan. It takes up the full issue of this Trumpet. It has a fantastic article from our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, titled This Is Not Incompetence, This Is Treason. And it shows that the reason these Biden officials are saying this was such a success was that it did go according to their plan. The caption on the cover is chaos by design. It was planned and intended to undermine American power, and it did that extraordinarily well. On today's program, we're going to look at some of the ways that it has done so and will continue to do so. Our first few stories discuss some of the wider implications of what has happened here, starting with the effects of a strengthened and legitimized Taliban. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Nachtigall.
I think this is definitely something that I think Americans aren't going to be too ready for. They've just removed their footprint from the country, at least the military footprint. And I think everyone, although it got done in a very horrendous way, and everyone can see just the chaos that led to the evacuation and the chaos of the evacuation, people might want to just breathe easy that it's done with now, at least we're out. However, as you introduced there, the scene that is being set in Afghanistan now means that Afghanistan is going to stay in the news for Americans. Because for a number of reasons, of course, you've got the Taliban that's in control, that are in cahoots with Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations as well, themselves being a terrorist organization. And so you can see that we just have a larger terrorist front now as well. The one aspect I'd like to focus on is this number that the Americans are giving of American citizens that the American government is giving of American citizens still in the country, somewhere around 200 American U.S. citizens that want to leave is what they're saying. And so there's obviously this figure is greatly the real figure is much larger than that. But let's just stay with this potential for 200 American citizens that are left underneath Taliban control and what is going to happen with these people. And you have Clifford May, who's just a wonderful commentator for a number of years, writes for the Washington Times and others. He wrote an article, The Taliban Calls the Shots, and he's looking at a potential situation where these people are going to be hostages for the future that the American administration is going to buy from the Taliban. And so this is going to, as he brings out, an amazing source of revenue for the future for the Taliban, for jihadis, based on what America will be willing to pay. This is what he says in his article. He says, in the end, several hundred American civilians are believed to have been left behind, stranded at the mercy of the Taliban, whose leaders are doubtless pondering, quote, should we further humiliate the satanic Americans as the Islamic revolutionaries did in Iran in 1979? Or should we sell the bodies Biden has generously gifted us? What's the going price for a captive infidel these days? And then he writes, do you doubt that President Biden will offer billions of dollars ransom for any Americans taken hostage? Whether cash arrives on pallets one way President Obama sent funds to the rulers of Iran remains an open question. Expect American money to be passed along to Al-Qaeda, just as Tehran helped underwrite Hezbollah and Hamas and so on. So what I want to focus on is the reason why America left this many people behind. This is chaos by design. This is a withdrawal that was intended to strengthen the Taliban, strengthen radical Islam. And it's not just the $80+ billion worth of arms that America has supplied the Afghan military that's gone into Taliban hands right now. It's the potential for the Taliban to be funded for years to come by the, or at least in the time period to come, by the United States, if the United States wants to get back these hostages. Now, recall what happened in 2016. There was $1.8 billion worth of cash that was given to Tehran for four Americans. So just using the figure of 200, certainly the Taliban isn't going to ask for anything less than what Tehran asked for to get their Americans back. That's about $0.45 billion per American citizen. So if they go by that math, that's about $90 billion that the Taliban will be expecting from the United States to get their 200 citizens back. And that would be a greater GDP than, I think, the bottom two-thirds of the nations of the world. That would be four times the GDP of Afghanistan right now in one foul swoop. And so we might be thinking about America is done with Afghanistan. Think about the money now that the Taliban will be expecting from America.
Yeah, of course, the big question would be, what does the Taliban do with $90 billion? Should that eventuate? It's certainly going to be some kind of a horrendous sum in addition to the millions that the United States already left behind. Where does all of that funding go to, if not greater terrorist activity?
Right, and that's what the Taliban has done with it in the past, and that's what the Iranians have done with it as well. And so if you're the United States and it is your policy to strengthen radical Islam in the Middle East, you have provided yourself with the perfect cover to legitimately do that, to provide it with the funds that it needs to really attack the American homeland, to attack the state of Israel as well. And how else can you see the Taliban using these funds? They've already had military parades about with all the arms that they've gotten from the United States, and they're going to expect this money. And if this is the worst foreign policy decision that the United States has made, expect this to have huge ramifications for the United States security going forward, and also for the state of Israel. I do think it would be good if people, along with reading, obviously, the new trumpet that comes out, I think a great article for people to go to is from back in 2003, written by Mr. Gerald Flurry. The article is entitled "Why We Cannot Win the War Against Terrorism." And he talks about how every step that America makes in this war, that it's actually going to, unless they address the fundamental cause of it based in Iran, that it's actually going to turn around and empower the enemy. And that's what we're seeing take place right now in Afghanistan.
Yeah, and I don't think Gerald Flurry could have even foreseen near the scale of the degree to which this has played out against America's interests in recent weeks. We thank you very much for that. Go check that out, Why We Cannot Win the War Against Terrorism. We're going to look now at Europe, which is taking America's failure in Afghanistan as a massive prod to step up its own military cooperation and capabilities. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Afghanistan has accelerated the efforts to push for a European military in a very practical and very tangible way. I mean, we've talked about some of this already as we've gone through the fallout from this massive event, but I think there's been a real focus on this that has come across in the last few weeks. Deutsche Welle, for example, they had an article just yesterday, "Is the fall of Kabul the kick European defense needs?" And the head of the EU's kind of equivalent of their foreign minister, he has been going around all week really emphasizing this, hitting this point very hard. Afghanistan has shown that the deficiencies in our strategic autonomy come with a price, he told a meeting of defense ministers on Thursday. Again, just the fact that Afghanistan falls and the EU defense ministers are getting together and having a meeting tells you something. But he says the only way forward is to combine our forces and strengthen not only our capacity, but our willingness to act. And you've got other people, the European Council President Charles Michel, he's talking about how Europe can't be content having to rely on America in these kind of situations. That foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, he's been going and talking to other different newspapers. He said, as Europeans, we have not been able to send 6,000 soldiers around the Kabul airport to secure the area. The U.S. has been. We haven't. You know, we talked last week about how Europe wanted to stay beyond August 31st. And what has especially rattled this week is that Europe knows they couldn't. Or at least, I don't know, maybe if there was more political will, they would have been able to find a way. But it would have certainly been very difficult to do that without American help. They understand that. And that is causing them to look at some very tangible changes.
We've talked about Europe building its military and its capability and its cooperation for decades because of the Bible's prophecies of just what a military superpower Europe is going to end up being. There's always obstacles in the way. The European leaders have a very difficult time coming together and agreeing on anything substantial. There's just little, it's probably the most slow-moving train in history as far as just looking at the way things are going prophetically. This is exactly the type of crisis inflection point that it needs to get past some of those obstacles and to come together in with more determination to make sure that things happen.
Absolutely. And like you said, a lot of the obstacles, a lot of the issues here are political as well as practical. So for example, one of the things that Joseph Borrell, this foreign policy chief, was talking about wasn't just more soldiers. Absolutely, it was more soldiers. He talked about Europe having a European initial entry force, which is an interesting term where you'd have these 5,000 strong troops. But also, it's the political ability to use what they've already set up. So they've come up with this plan for European battle groups where you have small forces of 1,500 troops. They've put a whole lot of that together where Europe has this rapid reaction force of 1,500 that's on standby that can be deployed. But it requires the agreement of every single one of the 27 EU member states. And so he said, well, you know, maybe the solution is to change that. So we just need a majority or a majority of Europe's you know, some form where it's not 27 member states having to sit down and have a meeting and every single one of them agreeing before they can do anything. So, yeah, it's these are political decisions. These are kind of hard political decisions. It's easy. I mean, to sign over control of your soldiers to another country, that's a huge deal. To imagine, say, America saying, okay, well, we're going to let Canada and Mexico make decisions about whether or not to deploy the U.S. military, that would be massive. And it is almost of a similar magnitude for Europe to make those kind of decisions. For France to say, okay, we're going to let a German general command our troops, or we're going to let Germany and Italy decide to send in our forces. It is something that takes a massive impetus. But you can see Afghanistan providing a large amount of that impetus.
What are some of the specifics that are being discussed now in the wake of the Afghanistan withdrawal?
So there are these talks about a rapid reaction force. One of the things that I find fascinating is there's a real focus on the ability to get European forces all around the world. You know, this big problem wasn't that in terms of getting Europe, securing Kabul, wasn't that Europe didn't have the soldiers. It's that it would struggle to get the ability to get them there. You know, logistics are kind of the boring nuts and bolts that you need to have a global military. And as of 2018, the EU had 63 transport planes, the UK owning, I think, the largest number. America had 250 plus. At the moment, when Europe wants to go anywhere in the world in a hurry, they need American help to do that. And Europe is already working on that. Just this week, the first Franco-German airlift squadron entered service at a French airbase. So, you know, you mentioned it's been a slow train. That train absolutely is moving forwards. And that was a significant step where they're cooperating with 10 Hercules transport planes so that Europe can react quickly like this. But this is one of the discussions that has really come to the fore just in the last week. Europe needs to have its own transport capability so that it doesn't have to get a lift from America. And you know, when you look at the Bible prophecies about what is going on here and about this European military power, and you mentioned this is a key prophecy, one of the things these prophecies all kind of talk about is its ability to move quickly, to come as a whirlwind, you know, to move in very fast into countries. So when you see Europe talking about military airlift capability and the ability to move quickly. They're working on that in very practical ways.
Where would you send people for more information just to understand how prophetically significant this is?
So we do have a trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, because you know, there are so many prophecies about the King of the North, the Beast Power, which all they all refer to this European power, and it's talking, these prophecies all talk about a ferocious military, and they're some of the most terrifying prophecies in the Bible. And then we're seeing the building blocks being built for those prophecies right now. So that goes through some of those prophecies. Who and what is the prophetic beast is also a great place because that puts it in context. You know, these prophecies are, they can be terrifying. But when you see them in the context of all of Bible prophecy and key Bible prophecies, they're just full of vision and hope. So who and what is the prophetic beast is a great place to go to understand that. And then finally, we do have an article from Josué Michels that just talks directly about what some of the news we've seen from the last week. That's called Afghanistan is Awakening Europe's Military Spirit.
All right, thank you. Richard has also written an article that is in this coming print edition of The Trumpet called Why Europe is Shaking, just discussing some of the discussions that are taking place within European capitals after America's withdrawal from Afghanistan, why it really is having a pretty major political and military implications on the continent. We thank you very much, Richard. Now, Japan, this is definitely a very little reported story, but Japan also quietly made some military advances in the Afghanistan withdrawal. To learn about these, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the world was, of course, watching very carefully as the U.S. made this chaotic exit from Afghanistan. But one thing that many onlookers may not have noticed was that as part of these evacuations, Japan's military, the so-called self-defense force, was breaking new ground in its military practice. So the Japanese dispatched one of their air self-defense force C-2 aircraft and also two of the C-130 transport planes in order to fly evacuation operations from Kabul to Pakistan. And the Japanese soldiers involved were authorized to open fire on aggressors in order to defend others. And they ended up successfully bringing some 260 Japanese military personnel out of the country, as well as a number of Japanese civilians and some Afghan civilians. So, you know, this may seem at first look like it's not really noteworthy, considering that so many other countries were all evacuating people from Afghanistan at the same time. But Japan is not just any country. And for it, this is deeply significant. Just a decade ago, it would have been impossible, both politically and legally, for Japan to conduct an operation like this because of their constitution, which bans so many military operations. So at that time, Japan would have had to ask the U.S. or some other country to evacuate their people for them, and they certainly couldn't have legally evacuated another country's citizens. But in 2014, Japan reinterpreted the pacifist clause of its constitution in a way that allowed it to exercise what's called collective self-defense and protection of foreign nationals. And this reinterpretation was made into formal legislation soon after. And the main outcomes from those legislative changes, at least as pertains to this story, were that Japan suddenly had the right to use weapons to protect others and the right to rescue personnel from foreign countries. So it seems innocuous, and it's all conveyed in language that, you know, makes it sound harmless, but it is a slippery slope. And it is something that's bringing Japan closer to military normalization. Michael Bosak of the Yokosuka Council on Asia-Pacific Studies wrote about this evacuation this week, and he said that this Japanese self-defense force was, in this evacuation, they were, quote, pushing new boundaries and breaking new ground in security practice. So, you know, this is a quiet move for Japan, but when you consider its constitution, when you consider its wartime history, and you know, those guidelines that were supposed to prevent them from ever becoming a normal military power again after World War II, you see that this was quite a notable move.
And when you put it in context with other moves that Japan has made to strengthen its military capabilities.
Yes, for sure. It was about 75 years ago now that the U.S. defeated Japan at the end of World War II. At that time, America put a stop to Japan's just unusually fanatical and brutal bellicosity. And at that time, America forced the Japanese to renounce war and even enshrined pacifism into their constitution. And in the beginning, that was truly a binding restriction on Japan. Japan was entirely demilitarized. But little by little over the years, the Japanese have made many small moves toward rearming. They've, you know, as we just discussed, they've reinterpreted that part of their constitution. They've also found creative ways to justify the development or acquisition of all kinds of offensive weaponry that is specifically forbidden by their constitution. That includes about 150 of America's F-35 stealth fighter jets, one of the most sophisticated and lethal warplanes ever built. So Japan is armed to the teeth with those. They've also been building what are essentially aircraft carriers to move those planes around on. Japan now has an overseas military base in Djibouti as well, and so much more. So if you look at Japan today, it's ludicrous to call it a demilitarized pacifist country. It actually has, by most metrics, the world's sixth most powerful military. And now that it has carried out these rescue operations and given its soldiers the right to open fire, I think we can expect the Japanese to start playing a larger and larger military role in Asia and beyond.
And how is that significant prophetically?
Well, it's the Bible talks about an end-time Asian bloc in numerous passages that will be one of the largest and most lethal military forces that has ever come together. This is described in numerous passages, but one of the most detailed is Ezekiel 38. And in this one, it actually names several of the specific countries that'll be grouped together in this bloc. It shows that it'll be led by Russia and that China will kind of be Russia's number two. And then if you look at verse 6 of Ezekiel 38, there are some ancient names there for the people that make up modern Japan today. Gomer and Togarma are both listed there. So it's clear that even though Japan is normalizing its military today, partly out of fear of China, that's one of the big reasons they give, in that third and final world war, Japan and China and Russia and several other Asian countries will actually be on the same side and even banded together. So when we see Japan today just normalizing its military, it is setting the stage for that Asian power bloc to be just a history-altering military power.
Well, we have a trend article at thetrumpet.com about this specific subject, why the Trumpet watches Japan's march toward militarism, that goes through some of that history as well as the relevant prophecies about this. We thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One member of the Taliban said he couldn't believe they were able to defeat the world's greatest military with just their Kalashnikovs. Well, there's a reason the Taliban were able to do that. They've gotten a lot of help from America's military and civilian leaders. Washington is taking extraordinary steps to weaken and gut America's military. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, after a debacle the size of the Afghanistan withdrawal, you'd expect that the U.S. military would take some steps to reform and to get some more like solidarity amongst its soldiers. And it actually is taking extreme steps to root out extremism within its ranks, but it's not the type of extremism you'd think. It's right now the military, instead of like trying to look for Islamic sympathizers or Muslim Brotherhood members within the U.S. ranks, it's taking an unprecedented step to purge our soldiery of conservative Trump supporters. One small story I'll just mention quickly that kind of feeds into this trend is that a top retired U.S. general and former CIA director, General Michael Hayden, who was CIA director under George W. Bush, he retweeted two pictures as all this is going on. One of them showing a Taliban caravan driving American Ford Ranger trucks with the caption, "They're Taliban." And then another one of like in America of like some rural people driving American Ford Ranger trucks with like Make America Great Again flags with the title, "Our Taliban." So basically liking the Trump supporters to being just like the Taliban. And then he tweeted another picture, another meme just shortly afterwards, suggesting that you round up all the unvaccinated Trump supporters and evacuate them to Afghanistan. And so now this is a retired CIA director just really joking around and making a fool of himself. But it does just highlight, I think, in a pretty profound way, just kind of the disdain that a lot of the upper top brass in America have for Trump supporters and conservatives, which is extremely significant because there's on a more serious note than retweets, there's a bill being introduced to Congress this week that would it's an amendment to an existing bill that would basically bar or expel people who espouse or act on extremist beliefs from the military. But now your question is, it's like, well, who's what specific extremist beliefs are they going to be expelling people for? Because mm-hmm. if you were to put General Michael Hayden in charge, he'd be expelling basically all the conservatives from the military. And they're not going to put General Michael Hayden in charge of that. But they are relying heavily on the Pentagon's Countering Extremism Working Group to define those extremist beliefs. And that's a group we've written about on our website and spoken about on this program before, a group headed up by a pretty famous critical race theorist named Bishop Garrison, who's gone on record saying that anyone who voted for Donald Trump is a misogynistic, sexist, racist, and is now putting protocols in place in the U.S. military to like troll through people's social media accounts, I think even their emails in some cases, basically looking for evidence of extremism so they can push from the military. And like I said, they've already had a couple high-profile firings of those who've come out warning that Marxism's taking the U.S. military. And it looks like this countering extremist group is going to be using this new bill in Congress to just really come through and find anyone who supports Donald Trump, anyone who thinks the election was stolen, anyone who thinks that the military is becoming Marxist, and purge them from the ranks in order to make the military, or what's left of it, a really radical left-wing force whose primary purposes are to protect the Washington elite from those who are mad at their elections getting stolen, and do things around the world like they've done in Afghanistan, empowering America's enemies.
It's a great point. I think the way that you framed that is extremely important, that you would think that given the disaster that's taken place here, that they would be more concerned about bigger issues with the military than these that they're pursuing. But they just continue to politicize the American armed forces. I think a lot of the decisions that have been made have shown, and you've written about this on thetrumpet.com, just how much the woke thinking, radicalized thinking on the part of American military leaders is distracting them from more pressing concerns for the military, and it's really weakening and undermining the military in many ways. And you can just see how, doesn't matter how powerful the United States military is, how many billions of dollars it spends on armaments, if the leadership isn't making good decisions, none of that matters.
Right. And it definitely feeds into two big prophetic trends we've been watching. One is just the entire prophecy there in Isaiah 3 about God taking away the strong leaders from Israel, the captain of 50 and the honorable man and the man of war, as you can definitely see when you're looking at the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the top brass and the CIA directors in America, that he has really taken away the strong military leaders who can just make sound decisions to defend the country. But also, as they're doing this, I mean, they're firing a lot of people who probably could make good military leaders, and even some of the people they aren't firing are resigning. And so they had another big letter this week from the group called Flag Officers for America. It's a group of about 90 to 120. They don't. It's kind of a loose-knit group. They don't sign every letter, but they basically of like of retired generals and admirals who are making commentary on the current Pentagon that they no longer work for. And that group, I mean, that's, I think there was a 90 generals and admirals this week who basically called on General Mark Milley and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to resign over this Afghan debacle. And then earlier this year, they published another letter warning the American people that the election was stolen and America was in a fight for its survival between communist revolutionaries who've taken over the military and those who actually espouse the principles of our founding fathers. And so you see a group like that, that you start getting more of these people fired or resigned from the military, start kind of gravitating towards this Flag Officers for America of people who used to work for the military but now are really working to warn America about the stolen election. And you can get a pretty big base of military support for President Donald Trump that would be prepared to help him in whatever way they can, politically or ballot-wise, to retake office, or even if, I mean, who knows what will happen if the Biden administration, if it is proved that the election was stolen and they try to reinstate President Trump, as our editor-in-chief has been telling us to expect, you might see some pushback from this new Marxist proletarian guard that the Biden administration's erecting to defend itself. But they don't seem to think that it's like the more people they fire, the more soldiers President Trump has on his side as well.
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting point. We're definitely in uncharted territory here, but this is really what Brad McDonald was writing about, the Trumpet.com's managing editor, in his Trumpet brief from last night. The title of that was How Afghanistan Could Help Donald Trump returned to the presidency, and he was talking about just, you think about all of these soldiers watching what's been happening here and just how all of these decisions on the part of America's civilian and military leaders are undermining what they've devoted their lives to and just how betrayed they must feel and really how they have to be looking at the direction that the country is going and just saying, well, what can I do about this? And you start to just create scenarios, potential scenarios here with the numbers of people involved, the passion of the emotions that are involved, and some of the bitterness that is being created. And you could see this playing out in ways that do fulfill those prophecies. Gerald Flory has even made some comments about how we could be in store for a civil war among America's military forces, and there could be some that that side with the former president.
Right. Yeah, if you're trying to put, because it's never happened in American history before where an election's declared illegitimate and like the previous president's reinstated. There's some evidence that John F. Kennedy's election was fraudulent, but they just rolled with it. But if you're looking, like I said, like Mr. Frilly's been telling us to expect, based on those prophecies in Amos 7 and 2 Kings 14, to actually have President Trump come back to power even before the 2024 election, I almost couldn't see how there wouldn't be some civil unrest when that happens, that you need some soldiers to pacify.
Well, we will definitely keep our eyes on that. Go check out that article from Brad McDonald. We also have an article we'll put in the show note, in the link links on the show notes for today's program, America's Coming Civil War. Thank you, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, some non-Afghanistan related stories. But first, we'll look at what the people of Iraq are thinking as they ponder what America just did. We'll also get an update on German elections coming up in just a few weeks, more Chinese belligerence in the South China Sea, and the devastation of Hurricane Ida. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The Biden administration justified its hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan by calling it a forever war. Well, there's another theater of war that it's been giving that title to, and that is Iraq. The people of Iraq are now bracing themselves for America to do something similar in their country. For this story, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the Iraqis really do fear, or many of the Iraqis really do fear the United States' exit, complete withdrawal from Iraq. There's about 2,500 soldiers right now. And they have said, the Biden administration has said that they're going to change their status from combat troops to more advisors by the end of the year. So perhaps there might be a few left around the place inside Iraq. However, witnessing the hasty withdrawal from Afghanistan, in regards to especially that the Taliban was going to take over, it does not make these Iraqis that fear that their country is going to fall completely to Iran happy. It makes them worried. We have an article that was written by Bobby Ghosh, I believe his name is, after Afghanistan, Biden shouldn't abandon Iraq too. The reason being is because Iraq, although you have Iran's influence that is absolutely massive and almost complete and almost total, the presence of such a small amount of U.S. forces really does give many Iraqi citizens hope that the United States will stay there so the country doesn't completely become another proxy for the Iranians. However, we do have a number of signs that what just happened in Afghanistan looks to happen in Iraq too. Several commentators are talking about how that a continuation of the nuclear negotiations with Iran will be a prerequisite for those to go ahead, will be the removal of all U.S. forces, all boots on the ground inside Iraq. And this would be, again, something very dangerous, something that's very similar to what we've seen in Afghanistan. However, when you consider that the geography of Iraq and the oil that sits in Iraq, Iraq is an even greater victory for radical Islam than even the Taliban would be as well.
Well, yeah, you have to look back at statements that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, made years ago talking about Iraq in particular, because that really does factor much more prominently in the end-time prophecies for that region that we've been watching.
Right. We fully expect that Iraq is going to fall to Iran. Our articles are probably in the hundreds now since about 2000 and, well, really since about 1994, saying that this was going to happen. And so this is something we report on all the time because Iraq is so essential for Iranians' power. Again, the oil, again, making sure you don't have an adversary on your western flank as well. It's just removed an adversary on its eastern flank. If you can just picture this, you had the United States' massive presence in 2002 and 2003 inside both countries that really did hem in the number one state sponsor of Iran, of terrorism, that being Iran. And so right now we've seen the American servicemen leave Afghanistan. So that's their eastern flank that is protected now. And then you have American servicemen that are about to leave Iraq as well, which would give it complete and total control all the way from Pakistan going across to the Mediterranean. This is terrifying. This is terrifying for Israel as well. This is what Ghosh writes. He says, a withdrawal from Iraq would leave America's most important ally in the Middle East exposed to an even greater danger from the implacable hatred of the Islamic Republic. This is, I mean, American servicemen, again, it's just 2,500 troops. But when they're embedded with Iraqi military that are against the Shiite militias that Iran controls, when they're embedded with the Kurds, when they're embedded with the Kurds in Syria, when they're embedded with the Afghan military, it's a strong force because no one dares touch you, or at least they're very scared to touch you. You remove them, and then there is nothing stopping Iran's complete domination of that nation, as we've seen the Taliban take over from Pakistan. I really do want people to go ahead and read just the long-standing forecast based on the Bible for this region from Mr. Gerald Fleury, the King of the South book. It is all these decisions by the Biden administration, they're empowering radical Islam led by Iran, which is what the Bible calls the King of the South. And just as Afghanistan's fallen, we can expect Iraq to go sometime soon as well.
All right. Thank you very much, Brent. Germany is scheduled to hold elections in just over 3 weeks. The end of the Merkel era is in sight, and the nation could be in for some radical changes. For this story, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, this is shaping up to be easily the most unpredictable election, I think, in German history, maybe. Nobody knows. in terms of what the what type of coalition or any what's going to emerge out of these elections, I think, in 3 or 4 weeks. And we've had some massive changes. Just even, you know, we spoke about German elections on this show 3 or 4 weeks ago, and we've seen huge changes since then. You know, last time we talked about this, we were talking about how Angela Merkel's party was still in the lead, but that they were on record lows and that they were barely in the lead. Now that's gone. You know, it's flipped completely. They're in second place. They have not been in second place in German politics for years. I think it's 8 or 9 years. It's a shocking shift. I like the National Interest had a good headline this last week. I think it was just yesterday. Is Germany on the verge of a political earthquake? Again, talking about the uncertainty on display here, talking about how we could soon see things that we've just never seen before in recent German history. This article says, never before in the history of the Federal Republic of Germany have the polls been so bad for the governing Christian Democratic Union. You know, this isn't just, you know, bad for the last couple of decades. This is their worst since World War II kind of levels, and it's tumbled just since just over the summer. This article talks about how, you know, now the party that is in the lead is the Social Democratic Party, and suddenly what looks like a very probable coalition is a coalition between the Social Democrats, the Greens, and Die Linke, which, you know, the Die Linke used to be is kind of like the up to date version of the East German Communist Party. You know, until a few months ago, the party's leader was a member of a radical Trotskyist group. So, you know, these are out-and-out communists, and now people are talking about them being the next, you know, in government in Germany. This is the kind of uncertainty that we're looking at in Germany, where we could have Trotskyists as ministers in German government. I can't say that very well, apparently. But anyway, lots of big potential changes, and that's, you know, I think that's the CDU's latest line of attack, vote SDP, get Die Linke. They're taking advantage of the fact that the SDP used to rule out ever being in coalition with the left party, and now they've stopped doing that. But you can sit down and come up with all kinds of different potential coalitions, and it's very hard to say which one will end up being the one that succeeds, if any do.
The uncertainty within German politics is just an ongoing story. I was actually just looking at the Trumpet issue, the cover of our Trumpet from 4 years ago, where we had a picture of the Reichstag and earthquake that kind of ripped going right through the Reichstag. That last German election really was a political disaster for Germany in a lot of ways. Angela Merkel was still at the helm at that point. And so even though there were big problems in trying to forge a coalition at that time, you still had somewhat of a steady hand, or at least a sense of the continuity of the German government at the time. This is kind of 2016 on steroids, isn't it? Or 2017.
Absolutely. That's a great way of putting it. I mean, yeah, you had that continuity with Ms. Merkel being there on the scene, overseeing all the negotiations. And then the result, you know, even though it was Germany's longest coalition negotiations in history, the result was something that Germans are very familiar with. It was another left-right coalition, something they'd seen before many times. Whereas this time round, it looks like that's not going to be the case, that the result is going to be something radically new, that Angela Merkel will be going, so we're going to have a new leader. So you do have this kind of, you know, like you said, 2016 on steroids.
Where would you send people to learn why it's so important to watch German politics and where this might end up ultimately, according to what the Bible prophecy says?
So we have a little booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent, and that will answer those questions. I mean, in terms of what's going to happen this election, we don't know. The Bible doesn't say specifically, but these elections do tie in directly with the patterns that the Bible talks about and the ultimate direction. You know, there are prophecies that talk about a strong leader rising in Germany, and he says he's going to come into the picture not through the regular political kind of processes. He's going to come in by flatteries, by an unorthodox method. And so this kind of chaos, you know, you could, or uncertainty, you can see that leading to people wanting a different kind of government, You can see that leading to stalemates. You can see that leading to just a breakdown of the political process. That's the direction Germany's been heading into in for several years. It's worse now than ever before. And the Bible tells us the ultimate destination of this direction.
All right. Thank you very much, Richard. I'm also going to put a link to that trumpet cover from 2017.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good.
Go check that out and read that booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. We appreciate that very much, Richard. China is increasing its belligerence in the South China Sea. Yet again, for this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, quite a troubling announcement from China this week. The nation's Maritime Safety Administration said that from now on, any ship passing through any waters that China claims will have to contact Chinese authorities and provide a detailed report about, you know, what they're hauling, who's on board, their call sign, their next port of call, estimated time of arrival, and so on. So the Global Times, which is a mouthpiece of the Chinese Communist Party, carried this announcement, and part of it said, quote, "Operators of submersibles, nuclear vessels, ships carrying radioactive materials, and ships carrying bulk oil, gas, and other toxic substances are required to report their detailed information upon their visits to Chinese territorial waters. Vessels that may endanger the maritime traffic safety of China should also follow the new regulation." So this broad definition basically applies to any ship, whether military or commercial, in waters that China claims as its territory. And the worrying thing is just the huge amount of ocean that China claims as its own. They have what's called the nine-dash line policy, which basically means the entire South China Sea falls into this category. That's an enormous area about the size of India that China wants to assert this control over. And it's an area that's home to some of the world's most important shipping lanes. Trillions of dollars in goods sail through this part of the world each year, including about 60% of Japan's energy imports and about the same amount for both Taiwan and South Korea. So when you put it all together, it equals 21% of all global trade that passes through this area. So to have China saying, anyone who wants to sail through here needs to check in with us and get our approval first, that has just very worrying implications for those energy import dependent economies in Asia and for free trade in general.
It seems we were just talking recently about how much other nations, and the United States most notably, have ensured that they've been able to continue to sail through what are legally international waters and to assert a certain amount of pushback against China's efforts to claim unilateral control over this area. China doesn't seem particularly concerned about that.
They don't seem concerned at all, and it clearly is an unlawful move that they're making here. The United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS, is an international treaty that sets out the legal framework for ocean activities and boundaries and things like that. UNCLOS makes clear that a country can establish a territorial sea only up to 12 nautical miles from its coast. So you can't just draw some arbitrary line on the map hundreds of miles out and say everything on this side of this line is ours. And then UNCLOS also stipulates that vessels of all countries enjoy, quote, the right of innocent passage through the territorial sea. So these are clear international laws that most nations abide by, and that's why China's claims under its nine-dash line are illegal. These claims are entirely contrary to UNCLOS. But of course, UNCLOS is part of the UN, and that means that there really isn't any way to enforce those laws. So unless individual nations stand up to China's illegal claims and just demonstrate that they refuse to submit to these unlawful new reporting requirements, there will be nothing, I think, to stop this from putting the South China Sea just even that much more firmly in China's grip.
Yeah, the enforcement of the laws, that's always the crux of it, isn't it? Like any international body can just say, well, this is legal or this is illegal, but without the power to back that up and to ensure that those laws are actually adhered to, nations are free to do what they want. And this is, it's interesting to see this taking place just in light of everything that's happened in the United States, with the United States over the last few weeks. People are, you know, they're happy that America is out of Afghanistan. They wanted to get out of Afghanistan. They wish that it would have been done in a nobler way or a more orderly way. But there's this general agreement that America needs to pull back from areas like that. If the world doesn't have a policeman, then you basically have kind of the law of whoever the strongest is going to be able to do what they want to do. China will take advantage of that. I would expect that this is exactly the kinds of actions taken on the part of a great power like China and others that we can expect to see more and more of in the time ahead.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think that Afghanistan, the situation that happened there with the U.S., that is emboldening China. Yep. And China understands more and more that America's policing days are over or quickly coming to an end. And so we should expect them to be making more and more announcements like this and asserting more and more control over areas that legally they do not have control over. But, you know, short of an enforcement, they'll continue to do everything they can.
If people want more information, where would you direct them?
Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote what I think is really a landmark article in the August 2020 issue of the Philadelphia Trumpet. It's called "Where Is the China-America Clash Leading?" And he spent some time shining the spotlight on all of China's dangerous, just its domineering there in the South China Sea and how China's just taking over that area. And then he puts it all in the context of Bible prophecy. He especially emphasizes a prophecy in Deuteronomy 28 about the U.S. losing sea gates and important shipping hubs that it once had control over and losing them mainly to China. So we really see this happening in detail in the South China Sea because America kept that region of the world open to trade pretty much since the end of World War II. But now China is well established there. And even though America and some of its allies have been making some efforts to stand up to the Chinese, China is slowly pushing them out. And if China enforces these new reporting requirements, that'll just be another huge step in that direction.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. One final story, terrible devastation in America from Hurricane Ida, the most recent climatic disaster to hit the country. To learn about this, we'll go back to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, Hurricane Ida made landfall in Louisiana on Sunday as a Category 4 storm. It had a maximum sustained winds of 150 miles an hour. And so for comparison, in the past 70 years, there's only been five storms that have hit the state of Louisiana with wind speeds that high or higher. I think it was the fifth most severe storm to have hit Louisiana in those 70 years. And so just a really catastrophic damage from the winds and the rains and also from the flooding. There's been about 46 people who've died that we know of so far. And the insurance companies are estimating that the damage will be about $18 billion. And so yeah, that's billion with a B. So huge amount of damage, going to be taking the city a long time to rebuild and recover. And then especially because of its location down there, right on the Gulf Coast, where America has so many of its offshore oil rigs and oil refineries. I think many of those oil refineries are just completely closed down, which means that gas prices are going to go up all around the nation. So there will definitely be some economic hurt from this. And the of course, as is generally the case, as we see natural disasters like this, the go-to example of the mainstream media is climate change. Although that is interesting, with just a little bit of digging, I mentioned that this was the fifth strongest storm in the past 70 years. There's only been five that have had winds above 150 miles per hour. And three of those five storms actually occurred in the 1960s and 1970s when the Earth was cooling slightly and the media was in a huge freakout over the global cooling scare before it was replaced by the global warming scare. So there's actually more hurricanes happened as the Earth was getting colder than have when it's getting warmer. So it's about 50-50. If the Earth's cooling down, you've got three bad hurricanes. It's warming up, you get two bad hurricanes. So that should shoot that argument out of the water. And as our book that we'll put in the show notes, why natural disasters explains is that, I mean, natural disasters, they've occurred throughout human history from ancient times to modern times, but God always uses them to get people's attention and wake them up to the fact that something in their society is wrong and needs to be repented of, because otherwise God would not allow disasters like this to happen. Actually, the one scripture that comes to mind is one of the Psalms, Psalms 148, verse 8, where it says, fire, hail, snow, vapor, and stormy wind fulfilling his word. So this is like God's word. It's fulfilled with wildfires like we see in California. It's fulfilled with hail when that happens and snow when that happens. But then also the stormy wind, which 150 miles per hour is definitely a very stormy wind, and something that like I said, God sends to wake America up to know that there are problems that go far, far deeper than rising carbon levels from SUVs.
Why natural disasters? It really is a powerful booklet. There's a lot packed into that, including this just recognition of what a red herring the climate, the man-made climate change argument is. But really directs you right to scripture and points to just what an important issue this is for us to recognize the real cause of, so that we can take steps to correct it. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us any thoughts on the program just by sending that to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Carl Schurz. Ideals are like the stars. We never reach them, but like the mariners of the sea, we chart our course by them. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.